Welcome to A Storm of Spoilers, Season 2. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and my favorite Spider-Villain is late-stage Dan Slott-written Dr. Octopus, who takes over Peter Parker's body. Not the Dr. Octopus that, like, married Aunt May back in the day. That's weird, but late-stage.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and my favorite Spider-Man villain is Kingpin. And I'm going to blur together my impressions of Kingpin that come from both Vincent D'Onofrio's version on Daredevil for Marvel Netflix and this Liev Schreiber version that we get in Into the Spider-Verse that is like this great design inspired by Bill Sienkiewicz's 1986 design. Anyway, Kingpin, he's huge. He's gooey on the inside. I'm a fave.
Gooey on the inside.
Just wants his wife. That's all he wants.
We're here to talk about Into the Spider-Verse, which both Joanna and I have seen. Neil was unable to make it to this recording and to Into the Spider-Verse, from what I understand, although that might have changed by the time you've heard this episode. We're going to release this slightly before Into the Spider-Verse comes out, although it is, I believe, out in the UK as of right now. So just for you Americans, there will be a spoiler section at the back half of this podcast. Feel free to jump off and go see the movie and come back. We'll talk about, you know, some spoilery things that happen in the movie and then maybe some like crazy speculation about the Marvel Cinematic Universe because, you know, we have an Avengers trailer and things. We're also going to have a bonus segment if you are a Patreon subscriber at the Maester or Small Counts level at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. We don't know what that's going to be yet. It's going to be a surprise. Lots of good pleasant surprises here in December from Storm of Spoilers. This is your weekly reminder that Con of Thrones tickets are on sale. Con of Thrones will be next July 12th through 14th. That's 2019 now. We're in December 2018 in Nashville, Tennessee. That'll be after the final season of Game of Thrones. It's going to be much fun. It's a Game of Thrones convention. We've talked about it before. We've done live shows there. Come back if you've seen us there before and come visit us if you haven't been there yet. Yes, it's all good timing. Because, you know, stuff's meeting at the Trident, anticipation's high. Joanna.
Should our bonus episode be about Game of Thrones probably this week? I don't know. We'll talk about it.
Is there that? Well, I guess there is that spoilery stuff. Maybe that'll be the surprise.
We'll see what we have to say in a few days from now. As for my part of this section of the podcast, I want to remind everyone, if you are doing some holiday shopping for the Storm of Spoilers lover in your life, you might want to go to chaosislit.com and check out our merch that we have up there. We've got some fun shirts, some enamel pins, make for great little gifts and stocking stuffers. Also, I want to note that our small council members in our Patreon subscriber Slack did a little Secret Santa exchange this year, and it's like goddamn the cutest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Everyone's giving each other very great gifts. Some of them are Game of Thrones themed, some of them are not, but it's really fun to watch. So join that community if you care to, and if you do, this episode will be coming out after our latest movie club watch, which is Love Actually, which we are forcing Dave to watch. He has never seen it. We'll be watching it with our small council member, so we will have already seen this. And our next movie club will be in the new year, so we will see you all then. Last thing of my section is to read a couple reviews that we got recently. And I am going to start with one from Reginator Cakes, who left us a review in lieu of a holiday bonus. So thank you so much. 5 stars, favorite pop culture podcast. She wrote, well, since they wouldn't insert fries, shut up and take my money gif here, the next best thing is to write a 5-star review I've been meaning to write for Joanna and her boys anyway. Not only do they provide incredible witty commentary and insight for Game of Thrones, but they've now taken that superb content to all pop culture, in the off season tour. I'm not always interested in seeing the films they cover, but I always tune in because you're guaranteed a good time listening to Joanna, Dave, and Neil banter and discuss the merits of a film. The off-season tour. That was better that time. Okay. Has now become my favorite part of the year, and I'm mostly writing off-season tour more than once because I like it when Joanna mimics Dave's whisper when she reads off-season in a review during the pod. They've created such a fantastic podcast and amazing Slack community for their Patreon subscribers. Seriously, it's the best place on the internet, guys. Think Twitter, but like happy and fun. That have made a donation to Toys for Tots in their honors. Pew, 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 pew. Thank you, Reginator. That's
excellent.
A beautiful review. And I'm going to do one more from Please Never Stop 5 Star or Matt Pigs. Please Never Stop 5 Stars. I'm listening to these wonderful people talk about nerd stuff for over 2 years, and SOS remains my mainstay podcast. I feel compelled to finally write a review when I found out today that it's Neil's birthday, because it's mine too. Happy birthday, Neil. This review is my gift to you and Dave and Joanna. Anyway, the insightful discussions every week keep me engaged, whether or not I'm familiar with the subject. I'm always excited to listen, and I get especially excited for all the highly anticipated installments, mostly those Marvel Star Wars joints. I look to all three of you and your colleagues, especially the Fitwear folks, every time I'm looking for a hot take or general impression, and I'm truly grateful for that. I also just want to say that I love the pew, pew, pews. Don't ever change. # haven't fallen down. So thank you guys so much. If you want to leave us a few more reviews to round out, to last us through the new year, we would so appreciate it. Thank you guys. Next, what do we do next without Neil, Dave?
Oh, no. Yeah, that's right. I have to step in and take over the responsibilities of saying, we're going storm chasing.
Pew, 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 pew.
In case this is your first time and this has all been very confusing reviews and nonsense talk to you, this is where we talk about other pop culture we've been consuming during the week. It could be a movie, show, book, story, podcast, etc. This week we have a movie and a video game. Joanna, why don't you go first?
So last night I watched for the second time the awards season hopeful Star is Born, starring Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper, directed by Bradley Cooper, co-starring Sam Elliott in one of my favorite performances of the year. This was kind of a mixed bag for me when I first saw it, and actually I liked it even less the second time I saw it, maybe just because watching it home and distracted and impatient or something like that. But I still am of the belief that this is a very strong first half, or at least first third of a movie, because it's one of many, many 2+ hour movies of the year. First third of the movie, I think, is really strong. And then I think it gets a lot weaker. Dave, you also saw this recently. What do you want to say about A Star is Born?
Yeah, I saw it last night for the first time, and I completely agree with you that it is propulsive and touching, and all the performances are very engaging. For the first 45 minutes, or basically up until he drags her up to play the Shallows, and she acts that entire scene so well that it sort of reminds you that you might not learn anything more about that character. Or at least that's how it ended up playing to me in hindsight, because it sort of seemed like after that, the development of the Lady Gaga character's internal monologue, Allie's mm-hmm. internal monologue, was sort of placed entirely on performance. And Lady Gaga's good, but I don't know if it completely fills that gap, or yeah. at least was enough to make me comfortable with the overall narrative of poor rich white guy that led a long, fulfilling life.
Well, what's interesting is I agree with you, rolling my eyes, poor rich white guy, and while I also get really frustrated with some of the narratives of that film, it's annoying to me that he's right about the direction that Ali's career is going in, and I don't he's right, she's making wrong moves, and I don't like that at all. While at the same time, I don't disagree with him. I see a lot of problematic messaging. I see a lot of stuff going on in this movie. I still will tell you that I think Bradley Cooper's performance is incredible, and I think his direction is really good. I really think that the back half of the movie falters because Lady Gaga, though quite good, is not up for shouldering her half of the whole thing. So that's my take on the film. I have just a 1, 2, 3, 4 more hot takes on it, which is, number one, Shallows is not the best song in the film. The best song in the film is Always Remember You This Way, which she performs, I think, a song and a half later, solo, I don't know why that's not the song of the film. It's a much, much better jam, I think. Number two, I wish there were more drag queens in this movie. The drag queens are great. It's the second movie of the year, along with Netflix's Dumplin', to feature a RuPaul Drag Race alum in a role that I wish was like most of the movie.
Oh, is that the Jackson Boobs guy?
No, the host of the friend. Drag show. Yeah. Oh, no, not the friend.
No, the host. Okay.
Yeah. That's Shangela from, Drag Race. And, So those two hot takes. I know this is not my award season podcast, Little Gold Men, but I will tell you that I'm currently in crisis over my supporting actor feelings this year, because Sam Elliott, I think, with actually very little material, is quite extraordinary in this film. And Sam Elliott is the kind of actor where I look at him and I'm like, I want you to have an Oscar, like, for your career, right? Sam Elliott should have an Oscar. And I worry that you won't get another opportunity after this to have an Oscar. But on the other side of that is Richard E. Grant in the film Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is a much, much bigger supporting actor role. He's also extraordinary in that he is another actor that I'm like, I want you to have an Oscar, and I don't know how many other opportunities you're going to have to get one. So those are like two, you know, embarrassment of riches, those two guys. And then the last thing is Bradley Cooper's real dog, which co-stars in the movie, is impossibly cute, and I love it very much. So,
oh, that's why he and that dog had such good chemistry.
Yeah,
that makes sense. I agree with most of what you said, except I would flip the Bradley Cooper performance in directing. I think it's like a superb directing job, and like an interesting character choice that had me turning up the volume on my TV very high. So, you know, good things just didn't work for me necessarily as well.
I think the point when he like tries to explain the mumble was like stolen from Sam Elliott, spoiler for that plot twist, I guess, if you want to call it that, that to me like makes it okay that he's borderline incoherent sometimes. But the directing, I mean, like the kinetic camera work in the musical performances, that propulsive nature that you're talking about, I think you feel that a lot in like the early concert footage. I just think it's really like incredibly shot. So there you go. Star is Born. David, would we recommend it?
Yes. I think that it's probably going to be that type of, you know, drama that my parents would like watch for pleasure, and considering I'm now closer to their age than I was to my age, then I guess yes, it's probably good for a lot of adults. It's an adult movie for an adult, made well, and you don't have to deal with anything too horribly specific or weird.
I will say on my part, I really wish, or no, I will say this. I enjoyed it so much more in the movie theater than I did at home. And it might be first time versus second time or whatever, but I think is it too late maybe to see it in the theater? Probably, but
no. I think they're still playing some places
If you're going to see it, I really recommend you see it in the theater, because I think at home the drag of the back half just is even, you feel it even more. So that's what I would say. All right. Oscar bait movies aside, Dave, what have you been chasing recently?
Well, I realized I brought this up in the Slack when I was talking to some people about the Endgame trailer, and I realized I hadn't updated the podcast that Neil went and played the Spider-Man game by Insomniac on PS4. Made me insanely jealous, and I was with my group of friends. All three of us shared a single copy and would go to our friend's house to play the game on PS4. And then Black Friday happened, and there was a $199 PS4 plus the Spider-Man game deal, which is like at least $100 off the normal price. And I cracked and bought the PS4 for Spider-Man, and have been proceeding to live out playing Spider-Man ever since Thanksgiving, Black Friday.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. From a, like, a storytelling standpoint, it's been very fun to play through. Because I, in video games, one of the things I like the most is outfits. I've been, and one of the things And one of the things Spider-Man PS4 does is you have to, you know, complete 100% of the game to get certain outfits. So I'm going to complete all of this game to get all the outfits. I think I have, like, 20 more percent of the latest DLC, and then the final one comes out sometime in December. Might actually be out by the time you've released this. And then I get to play all the way through it, and it is super fun, and it has been really interesting to see Sony be so nice to the PlayStation Spider-Man, and then Marvel be so nice to the PlayStation Spider-Man, in that PlayStation Spider-Man shows up in Into the Spider-Verse, and PlayStation Spider-Man shows up in the Marvel Spider-Geddon crossover event that's currently happening. So PlayStation Spider-Man is legitimately a Spider-Man now. I'm so happy that I got to participate in it because of Black Friday horrible capitalism. I just talked myself out of it a little bit. But it's fun. If you're going to play video games and you like Spider-Man like me and like all of his outfits like me.
Do you like Spider-Man, Dave?
I like Spider-Man. Oh. I like Spider-Man a lot.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be a good episode for Dave talking about Spider-Man. yeah, so I'll check in at the end of the episode because I hear there's going to be some sort of like crazy surprise, but especially how much the plot is taken from like the Dan Slott years, which were interesting years that I was reading Spider-Man comics. That's been fun seeing that play out in the game. Let's continue the Spider-Man wave and get into the Spider-Verse.
Hello, listeners. Dave here to tell you about StoryWorth, a service that helps you connect to your family and relatives in a unique way, regardless of geography. If you sign up at StoryWorth, you get a year's worth of weekly emailed prompts to the loved one of your choice. They can respond with their stories and photos uploaded via email or at StoryWorth.com, and their responses are emailed to you and any other friend or family member you want to share in the experience. You can save all of your stories on a website to access and edit at any time. Then, once the year is up, you get a hardcover printed book up to 500 pages of all the responses as a keepsake. I've been using it with my mom and using it as a way to find out more about the details of her life that are usually glossed over in our normal interactions, like that she considered herself a conservative dressing valley girl when she was growing up, whatever that means, or about the first time she had an escargot on a cruise and ended up liking it so much she ate it every night. She also ends a lot of entries with, "We'll be back," and then gets to go back and add to the memories on the website later on. You gotta try it. For $20 off, visit StoryWorth.com/storm when you subscribe. That's StoryWorth.com/storm for $20 off when you subscribe.
Wait, I have a question for you, Dave, before we dive into this. Would you call yourself an expert in spider lore? Kind of? Pretty close?
Maybe. So I think I've definitely read every issue of Amazing Spider-Man through, 2015, 2016? Let's say at least 2015, because around 2016 is when I started to have my disagreements with Marvel.
Okay.
But like, in terms of every spin-off comic and following Spider-Man arcs, I'm really only fluent from like the early 90s to 20-something. So really, I have like 20 years that I'm excellent at, but if you're talking about like 60s or 70s, I've read it. I could do my best.
Okay, so Dave, well, for expediency's sake, we'll call Dave our spider lore expert. I, however, am your friendly neighborhood novice, and we promise all of you that before we get into major spoiler territory, there's going to be, ample warning, or what do you think, Dave?
Yes, there would probably be ample warning.
Okay, so we've got some ample warning. So we're gonna talk about Spider-Verse spoiler-free right now, and the future of the Spider franchise at Sony. All of this is spoiler free with like news that's just out there available to the general public. And then we're going to dive into our spoilery thoughts on the film itself, as well as what the end of the film promises for the future, as well as some tasty Avengers Endgame stuff and some Far From Home rumors. So it's just a marvelous time at the podcast today as we talk about spiders and Avengers and that kind of stuff. stuff. So Dave, I want to start. I'm taking my usual role, which is on a Thought Bubble episode, which is I get to interview you. Can you start us off by talking a little bit about, I'll say this. I'm going to flip this. This is a more fan friendly question. Is this the best Spider movie?
It's definitely in the top three for sure. The reason why it's just in terms of quality. My argument of what's going to put it between, like, probably Homecoming and Spider-Man 2, which are very good live action entries, and Spider-Verse might sneak ahead of them to take the number one spot, is that Into the Spider-Verse is a movie about being Spider-Man. The other movies are about being Peter Parker Spider-Man. And I think a lot of the things that we got tired of in terms of Spider-Man lore are really linked to Peter Parker and really about one interpretation we had of Peter Parker, that he had to be tangled up in the Osborns and there had to be a Green Goblin, and like that sort of idea became the cage that the Spider-Man franchise got itself trapped into. And now that Marvel managed to sort of wedge it out with Homecoming and provide a new angle to Spider-Man, which I enjoy very much, but probably falls slightly below Spider-Man 2 because it's also partially an Iron Man movie and like a Infinity War, Civil War, like bridge gap movie. It's still, the Spider-Verse is now free to be about what does it mean to be a spider person or a hero in a much more generic way, instead of having to nail with great power comes great responsibility through some sort of white boy cipher. Now it can be anybody or anything.
Awesome. For my own purposes, I would put it at number one. I've never loved the Tobey Maguire movies the same way that some people have. Though, of course, I have like a lot of admiration for them. My personal ranking, I think I would put like Homecoming and then, Spider-Man 2. And I would put this above those two. And I've seen it twice. Dave has seen it once. I'm not saying that makes me like more of an expert, because obviously Dave is our expert, but I will just say that like, I think it improves upon viewing it over and over again. Whereas I think Homecoming might be, though I loved Homecoming, might be slightly diminishing returns, if that makes sense. So there's also, you know, it might be unfair to compare, because obviously Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is an animated joint. And so that means that like you can do so much more with a web slinger in terms of like just the balletic like grace and all of that that you see from all of our different Spideys. I should say really quickly that, you know, before we get further into this, that this film, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, is Sony Pictures Animation. So it's not, a Marvel movie, despite what you may think. And the main character in this movie, if you're not familiar already, is Miles Morales, who is, you know, on like an alternative, Spider-Man, or maybe alternative is not a word we want to use anymore. You've got a bunch of other spider people, including Gwen Stacy and some Peter Parkers as well. It was directed by Bob Parachetti, Peter Ramsey, Rodney Rothman, with screenplay by Phil Lord, though Chris Miller, his frequent partner, and they worked on like the Lego movie and Cloud with the Chance of Meatballs and some other things. He gets a producer credit, but this is basically Phil Lord's script. So, that's kind of the vibe we're working with here, is this like very like unshackled from what you usually feel like you need to have in a Spider-Man movie, even though those elements are there in the classic Lord and Miller style. They're like poked fun at. And that's, I think, what makes this movie a bit of a cut above the rest. Before we get more into plot details and that sort of thing, I want Dave to do his thing about the visual style of this movie, because ever since the first trailer came out, Dave has been talking about the extraordinary visual style of this movie that I think I didn't quite understand in full what it would be until I saw the entire film, where you've got blurring and something, are they called Bende dots? Is that right?
Yeah, the Bend-Aid dots.
Bend-Aid dots coloring, a lot of like thought bubbles and other things that make this look more like a comic book than any comic book movie we've ever seen. So Dave, do you want to take us on a little tour of some of the polygons, things that we should be looking at in this movie?
Sure. I mean, I've been sort of trying to read all the pre-release interviews that I possibly can to understand exactly what it is we are looking at, because first of all, my screening was in 2D. Have you managed to see it in 3D?
No.
I'd be really interested to talk to somebody that's seen it in 3D. I know they're going to offer some 3D screenings, but I don't know of a 3D screening that they held. And I think that might actually be a step too far in trying to do this many different types of animation looks at once, especially in the finale of this film. When, you know, the multiverse is put into peril, they make a lot of design and animation decisions about when and when not to use color and things to, I think, like, use silhouette to their advantage in fight choreography. And I think to use transitioning in between 3D with 2D's effects and, like, sort of very extreme lighting that sort of reduces 3D back down to 2D, which are all to say that they're a whole bunch of complex methods. It's not just they're animating puppets like we would are used to in a 3D animated movie. The puppet's definitely there, but there's also some sort of new element that they managed to invent, some sort of new technology that allows them to draw a 2D line that's then interpolated in 3D space based on the camera angle, from what I could tell. So they're allowed to go through and finish every single frame of this movie in a 2D animation process after they've rendered out what exactly they want the puppets to do. So what that means is that everything here is very purposeful, but you're not going to see a lot of camera tricks that you're used to in terms of like the camera actually existing, like lens photography tricks, lens flares. What they've replaced that with is like a blur, these Bend-Aid dots or different ways of lighting. So what your mind is going to do is it's going to think it's stop motion because they've reduced it down to 12 frames, which makes it a lot easier to process some of these 2D to 3D effects and when they're transitioning back and forth to making it look all comic booky. But it's also different from how we're used to seeing 24 frame per second or even up to 60 frame per second photography these days on special effects. So it's not trying to replicate being real at all. So once you settle into it, I feel like the world really envelops you and is making really strong animation choices to not only differentiate the spider people, but to put you either securely in a physical space that they have to that all these characters have to interact in. They're in a room, somebody's tied up, it's something very spatial. Or at the end, they just blow that up because the capability of a spider person to traverse like weird physics is just amplified in this animated world. So it's all really smart. I haven't seen a lot of these techniques used before, and because I think they'd be super time consuming if you're basically be drawing on frames otherwise. But it really does, I think, lend a really interesting look to the movie that's halfway between a print image and like a rigged animated 3D movie, so much so that I think you could take any still of this film and be able to tell by the composition of that still, like where the audience's eye is supposed to be focused, because everything else has been purposefully distorted or blurred. It's really smart.
What's interesting to me is that the second time I watched it through, a couple things. So I talked to the directors about their, and of course, you know, like you guys who listen to this podcast a lot know that I don't know like shit about polygons. So when I talked to the directors, I definitely had to have Dave like feed me some questions to ask them. So when I talked to them for a piece that will be up on vanityfair.com this week, you know, they talked about the motion smoothing. There's no motion smoothing in this, which is something, as Dave just mentioned, we are all like quite used to seeing as audiences, and that they had to fight to get it in because, Sony or the powers that be didn't, like, everyone was very resistant to it because it's such a revolutionary idea to do this without motion smoothing. What's funny is that, like, I am a person who usually gets very sick when there are certain experimental things done with cameras, like Blair Witch Project made me really sick. The Hobbit with a different frame rate made me very sick. Like, I just, like, I get emotion sickness really easily. I did not feel that at all with this, but I will say anecdotally, and it might be unrelated, when my friend and I were walking out of the screening today, there was a dude throwing up in the trash can of the movie theater. So, like, he didn't even make it to the bathroom, which was, like, 5 feet away. So, like, oh, wow. I don't know if that was related to that at all. We were just wondering if it might be. But, you know, like, but like I said, I'm usually the canary in the coal mine when it comes to this sort of thing, and it didn't upset me at all. So if you're worried about that, like, I wouldn't worry about it. The other thing I would say is that the camera movement that I noticed the second time watching is, what did you call? I feel like you've told me the official term of this, the, like, Spidey sense tingling lines that appear above a Spider-Man's head.
Oh, like, is there a name for that?
Yeah. Is there not?
I don't know, but I think that's a good example of, like, this new thing that existed, that this, like, 2D, 3D line technology that I don't understand.
So they do these, I think it's definitely in the trailer. You'll see a young Peter Parker sort of, like, give this sign of recognition to when he meets Miles, as in, like, oh, you're a spider person. I'm a spider person too. What they say, when this happens is, oh, you're like me. And these little, like, wavy lines appear over their head. And it also sort of happens when they sense danger. So it's a spidey sense. We know what a spidey sense is. But not only do the lines appear, but the camera moves, which is a funny thing to say sometimes in animation. But the camera moves, like, it turns to handheld very briefly when that happens, which is something I didn't notice the first time around, but was pretty interesting. So, so yeah, so that's some polygon stuff that you, like, you might not notice or understand all of the things that either Dave or I said. Usually Dave, I have to make Dave explain these things very slowly to me, but, the end result is that this looks more comic booky. The blur that you see, which the directors told me was meant to mimic, like, when a comic is misprinted and the colors are blurred, that's the sort of look they were going for with the blur. All of that, and the bendy dots and the hashing and stuff like that, I think it's just, you know, whether or not it's done for a practical reason, the, sort of overall effect is to give you something that looks more like a comic book on screen than anything I think we've ever seen, it's safe to say. So, all right. What other spoiler-free spider thoughts do we have?
If you're a fan of Miles Morales previously, you'll be happy to hear that basically most of his origin story remains intact, up through, I think, most of the, like, first 100 issues of the Ultimate Spider-Man comic book series. Obviously that took, like, a shorter period of time. This takes a shorter period of time because it doesn't have, like, hundreds of issues, so we don't have a lot of side plots at the school or whatnot. Unfortunately, Genki seems to have been left out of, that's Spider-Man's Asian roommate, who he does exist in this movie, but isn't, a character.
I don't think they have a voice actor for him because I don't believe he has a line. Right.
Right. But, that the spirit of that character initially was absorbed into Ned from Spider-Man
right.
Homecoming.
Right.
So it's one way or the other, all of, Miles Morales' origin is there. They don't skimp on it. I can't get more
too
detailed.
Spoilery, minor spoilers. Right. So, and then before we got into spoilers, you want to talk about, the future, the known future of the Spider-Verse. That is, any future animated that might be spun off from this, and then what they're doing on the live action side based off of both Venom and then, the Tom Holland Marvel co-owned deal. Just to recap really quickly, if you guys aren't following this that closely, is like, Sony owns the Spider-Verse. They have since the 90s, right? When they bought it from Marvel. A few years ago, they made a deal with Marvel to sort of, like, share custody of I believe one of the Sony emails that we all could see if we wanted to said, like, basically to Amy Pascal, who was the head of Sony Studios at the time, and, like, Spider-Man is, like, sort of a pet project of hers. I think another executive told her, like, it's still your baby, but Kevin Feige at Marvel is the right babysitter for your baby at this time. And so basically it's been, like, a co-owned, co-production where they lend Spider-Man over to Marvel Studios for Infinity War and Civil War, and we assume Avengers 4, Endgame, and we get these Tom Holland movies, which are co-produced with Marvel. So that's, like, that's all shared, but what's just Sony, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, is the stuff they're building out from Tom Hardy's Venom, which did way better than anyone could have expected at the box office, and then what they might build out from this animated Spider Into the Spider-Verse launching pad. So, Dave, what do you want to say about all of that?
Well, I think we got announcements this last week that we're getting a animated Spider-Verse sequel that is may or may not be the same thing as the Spider-Gwen movie that they also said, that that character is going to reappear in her own movie. So they're at least splitting off a little bit on that, as well as news is that Morbius the Living Vampire starts going to start shooting in February, bolstered by Venom's success. I can't imagine what that confidence is going to do to Jared Leto's Vampire. But, you know, maybe if Into the Spider-Verse, if everybody likes Into the Spider-Verse as much as I liked Into the Spider-Verse, which is going to be nearly impossible, but let's say that it does happen, then what they've proven is that none of these projects need to be connected. So old Sony was like, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is going to be our springboard to all these different projects starring all these different characters. You remember Felicia Hardy's, like, in that movie? Well, she's going to be in her Black Cat movie, and maybe we'll have Emma Stone come back as Gwen. We don't know. Everything's on the table. It's a great time to be Spider-Man. And then, like, 6 months later, nobody was talking about any of that. Now, they don't need to have, like, a core springboard movie if Into the Spider-Verse proves that there's a Spider-Man language. It's like they might be able to spin off their own genre. So it's been really interesting to see what movies they've already said are like, yes, Into the Spider-Verse is previewing well enough that there's going to be another animated spider thing and that this character is coming back. Now I'm just waiting for Nick Cage's Spider-Man Noir to be announced to be back, and then I'll be happy as a clam.
Yeah, and one thing we should say about the live action side that we know about. So, like, we've got a Morbius movie with Jared Leto. There's a Kraven movie allegedly in production as well. And then there is a post-credit stinger on Venom that indicates where that all might go. I don't know if we feel like we can talk about that yet. But what the most interesting thing, I think, is one thing that the director of Venom said is that they kept that movie PG-13 with the idea that maybe someday Tom Hardy's Venom could fight Tom Holland's Spider-Man, or they could team up and fight a bigger spider enemy or something like that. So to keep it in the realm of, and, like, I think what we saw, you know, Dave and I, you and I've talked about this before, is, like, I think what we saw from the reaction to Venom is that people responded most of all to, like, the goofy, lighter side. And something you pointed out to me, Dave, is that, like, the way that they are advertising the home video release of Venom, they're like, they've got this, like, goofy rom-com sort of ad mm-hmm. going that makes it seem like Sony really understands what people responded to, which is, like, if Venom was trying to be two things, which was, like, dark and gritty, but also weird and wacky and zany, the zany is what seems to have landed better with audiences. And so the zany might be what they pursue going forward. How that translates to a Morbius the Living Vampire film, I don't know. Or a Kraven film, I don't know, honestly. Like, because it seems like they were kind of thinking of going, like, the WB route. But, like, you know, anyone worth their salt will tell you that they should probably go the Marvel route. That being said, Tom Hardy's Venom would not fight Tom Holland's Peter Parker, or team up with him, for that matter, I believe, until the Marvel Sony contract expires, which Tom Holland signed a 6-picture deal for that. So he's already got 4 down and 3 down, 3 to go, right?
Did he do a 6-picture deal?
Mm-hmm. That's what he said.
I think Tom Holland told the
Hollywood Reporter.
But there's a difference between I think they signed up for 2 co-productions and then 4 cameos or something like that. All I remember is that in the initial deal, the third Spider-Man Marvel team up was TBD, but everybody just assumed it was going to happen. But I think that was their escape hatch. Either way, they don't need the escape hatch. Homecoming was a hit. So yes, we probably have 3 more. Or we probably are going to have like a Sony solo Spider-Man trilogy. Homecoming, Far From Home.
Incredible Journey.
Yes, that's good. Homeward Bound.
It is murky. My understanding is that at the end of the day, Tom Holland will have done Civil War, Avengers, Infinity War, Avengers and Endgame, Homecoming, Far From Home, and Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey. Those would be his 6. I don't know what constitutes a cameo. Like, Civil War might constitute a cameo, but can we really call what he does in Avengers Infinity War a cameo? Like, that seems lengthier than a cameo. So, I don't know. It's complicated. Anyway, Sony's hands are tied a little bit. Like, they can't really do live action let me ask you this clarifying question. You indicated to me that you believe that one of the reasons why Miles Morales is the center of Into the Spider-Verse is not just because it's really, really cool to have a half black, half Puerto Rican Spider-Man, which it is, that it's really interesting to open the door to all these different spider people, which of course it is, but that they cannot put Peter Parker at the center of a film because of their deal with Marvel. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding. If you're thinking about how you're splitting out the rights, there's movies and TV. You could make animated TV with Spider-Man. Disney can and does. But the Peter Parker live action character could only be Tom Holland. And so if you're going to have a live action Peter Parker, from my understanding, Marvel needs to sign off on that. Like, I don't think it's impossible in Love and War and the billion-dollar IP that is Spider-Man that Tom Holland would never show up in a Venom 2, especially now that Venom's made more than every other X-Men movie and Disney was super interested in buying that property back.
Right.
So money could solve all sorts of problems. But initially, when this movie came out and it's like it's going to be Miles Morales, I was like, that makes a whole bunch of sense because you don't want to be building up somebody else's IP. If Peter Parker is a shared IP, everybody should be putting in as much as they're getting out to making live action Tom Holland's success. What you don't want is like one company making more money off the other, off the property. So having Miles Morales come in is great. And then having alternate universes Peter Parker teach him is also a great subversive way of reclaiming multiple Peter Parkers without necessarily violating the spirit of the agreement that Peter Parker wasn't supposed to be the head of everything. So the sly thing Into the Spider-Verse does is it has 2 Peter Parkers. The one that we start the movie with is actually not the one that's in the trailers for the movie is who you think it is. So the idea that there are all these multiple Peter Parkers sort of washes out the idea that Sony's feeding into the Peter Parker mythos. Instead, they just launched Miles Morales and Spider-Gwen and a pig. And now all those things are things that only Sony's going to make money on.
All right. So I think that's it for our non-spoiler section, right?
Yeah.
All right. Into the spoiler-verse. But first,
it's that time of the show again, where we thank our small council Patreon subscriber members. This is the final time before we figure out a way to do this that isn't just listing off people's names every month, but strap in, because it's still December, it's the last month. I want to thank Bria, Billy Bosky, James Cooper, Tyler Hannon, Jennifer Quinn,
Kirk Daniel Klein, Melanie Hsu, Lytherion, Vanessa Marshall, Corey Hilsey, Kelly Grady, Spencer Howard, Huang Li, Michael Sample, Severe Sigfus. Okay, no, I'm gonna give this the old college try. Severe Sigfusson, Iski I, Amy Reicht, Fanny Martin, Zachary Silverman, G, Just G, That's the Spirit, Joshua Lane, Hope Shock, Bethany Townsend, Danielle, Justin Young, Tasia Pender, Hannah Watkins, Mark Tozier, David Cox, Chris Saunders, and Daniel Baltimore. Thank you very much.
I'm going to thank Adam Wells, Louise Hallam Collins, Michael Filippini, Summer McCusker, Natalie Muskin Press, Brian Polito, Charlene Love, Tommy Fitzgerald, Dan Cleland, Michael Belitsky, Alexander Walgren, Dre, James Heath, Christopher McGrain, Sean Stringfield, Stephen Weathers, Warpstone, Derek Bachman, Marcus Mascarelli, Samba Muteba, Ajax, Greg Jagger, not sure, Luigi Oswego, Nathan Bodnar, Andrea Kudike, Stephanie Hoffman, Matthew McKee, Victoria Stout, Amy H., Kate Dilligan, and Stacey Jackson. Thank you guys so much.
And we're back to talking about Into the Spider-Verse spoilers.
Spoilerverse does whatever
Joanna,
Spider-Verse can.
When did you notice Chris Pine was Spider-Man?
Not until the closing song, genuinely, because I actually thought that Jake Johnson was just doing like a younger, like smoother voice.
Right.
But I was like, I thought that, but also throughout it, I was like, this does not sound like Jake Johnson. I guess he must have really tried to sound different as this Peter Parker. And then, as the full song was playing over the closing credits, I was like, that's fucking Chris Pine. See who that is. I guess I didn't even look at the credits. I was just like, oh, hey, that's Chris Pine singing. Dave, when did you know that Chris Pine was playing Peter Parker?
When you texted me, oh. Chris Pine sings in this movie. I was like, what? Chris Pine? Why would Chris Pine sing in this movie? And then I slowly put it together. And then when I finally saw it, I'm like, yes, oh my God, he's the Christmas album. And it is like interesting how many spiders this movie manages to fit in. And it just gets you speaking like Spider-Man, like it's a language, like with its origin callbacks and that sort of thing. With great ability becomes great responsibility.
Yeah.
Like sort of remixes of phrases like that. It was, I think it's like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs with Spider-Man. I think if you're like a normal fan, but if you're a Spider-Man fan, there's like tons of little Easter eggs and nods to you from like people in the phone to what's on TV. It is, amazing. I'm going to be frame by framing this movie when it comes out. For sure. But I also might have like a little bit of a weakness because I like all Spider-Man movies for like a couple of days to weeks after they come out. Just by their very nature. So I will say I feel like there was another version of this movie.
No.
That focused more on Miles' relationship with his dad.
There's much of Miles and his dad in this movie, though. I feel like this movie has so much room for Miles and his dad. I was really impressed.
It does. And I think it's a really good story decision for it to end up that way. But I do feel like him showing up at the climax with Kingpin there is a result of the cut speech that Peter Parker gives Miles Morales in the subway that is in one of the trailers where it's, you're not trying to save everybody, you're trying to save one person, which has been changed to sort of be your own Spider-Man in this final movie, which I think is a much better, you know, animated peg to peg an animated movie on. But it does make me wonder where that came about,
where the your universe is this limp fry and mine is this great fry scene came about. There's definitely content that was made that isn't in the movie. But you don't need it.
Like, I know, the friend that I saw with today mentioned that the fry scene was missing, and I was like, you don't need that fry scene because we already get it. You know what I mean? And so, like, either it was shot just for the trailer to give us trailer, you know, which we're increasingly seeing, giving us trailer content that's never has any intention of making in the film, or it was just cut because it's redundant. You know what I mean? I think, you know, or that's a part of the movie where it's dragging. Maybe it's dragging as Peter Parker's giving it. Like, I both agree and disagree with you. Like, I always love, Dave, when you play movie detective and you're like, well, this is missing and this is missing. And that's, like, always interesting to me. But I think why it's missing is not always, you know, because of the conclusion that we're drawing. Like, maybe it tested poorly. Maybe they were just like, we needed to get to the climax faster. You know, like, we don't know why it's missing. Do you know?
I'm not necessarily knocking it. I just think that I felt that there was a slight gap, because there's this whole setup that he thinks that Spider-Man killed his uncle, and then it's literally talked away in a line, which is fine because all the stuff in between that is amazing and is explaining Miles's character, and we don't need the dad to be a thorn in his side necessarily like he is in the comic books. But that being said, I do feel like there's one or two connective scenes as to how Miles's dad ends up being like the only cop at the climax.
I agree. Like, the second time I watched it through, like the first time I watched it through, I was like, wait, how did he get down to the basement? Wasn't he just up in the dining room? Wait, why was he in the dining room in the first place? And like the second time I watched it, I was like, yeah, he goes from like helping someone on the street, looking up to seeing the buildings in trouble, then going up to the big banquet hall. You see like one like brief shot of him there while he's telling Miles's mom to evacuate, and then he's down in the lab. And that's having just watched A Star Is Born, which does a lot of cutting, like just giving you the bare minimum of not explaining how a character got from A to B to Z. And like sometimes when people do that, it bugs me, like on the latest season of Game of Thrones or something like that. But in this case, I just feel like you don't need it. I think it's fine. Like, we see him, like, we want him there. We want him saying, like, get up, Spider-Man, get up. Like, that's something that we want. And I don't think I want to be dragged down in, you know, a red herring sort of like, exactly what you say, him being the thorn in Spider-Man's side. You know, and if that leaves room for a lot of the other stuff, you know, here's the question I want to ask you. And we're presuming that people are listening to this have already seen the movie, but maybe they haven't. But something that occurred to me the second time watching it is like, as I'm thinking about what Sony hoped to accomplish with this film, because it's not just like launching Miles as his own thing, but like introducing audience, like non-comic book readers unfamiliar with the concept of the multiverse to the concept of the multiverse, so that then they could do literally anything they want set in a million different multiverses and not worry about continuity or cross or anything like that. But you know, you and I, Dave, have been talking about some of the older projects that Sony was looking at doing, and one of them that got like derided, like broadly by people, was an Aunt May spinoff. But I, like, 4 years later, after Marissa Tomei and now Lily Tomlin, I'm like, you know what? I'd watch an Aunt May spinoff. Like, I really would. I definitely would. Like, this Aunt May, this, like, Alfred Pennyworth / whatever else, Q Aunt May, yeah, I'd watch her spinoff in a second, for sure.
Yeah. Another thing that is interesting in terms of trailer to even clips is they have completely removed Lady Octopus from the upstate New York chase. And that chase is like everywhere in the promotional materials, except for like the sound of a buzzsaw. I went back and like watched it again. And there's like a time when this is when the first time Miles is learning how to web swing.
Yeah.
And there is a shot where he's like running up a tree. And even in the trailer, they keep the buzzsaw. But it's like been really interesting to see that reveal, I think, really worked for me. Like, I knew there was going to be a female Dr. Octopus, but even so, just plot-wise, that reveal is placed and executed in a really good way. And I think that's what I respect the most about the movie, is I'm super into all of these characters, but it manages to take even the novice through all of the surprises at the same level as me. So I'm not, you know, I knew there was going to be a Lady Doctor Octopus. I'm not freaking out if there's a new concept. But the fact that the nice, you know, the seemingly nice lady that was on the educational film in Brooklyn Visions is actually secretly Dr. Octopus, and that Aunt May knows her later on, it's just like more and more payoff.
What's funny, so my journey with Doc Ock is this. I did not know, I knew very little actually going into Spider-Verse, other than like some of the stuff that Dave told me years ago. I didn't know Doc Ock was in this. Like, I knew Kingpin was in this. I didn't know that like Scorpion and Doc Ock and Prowler, even though I knew Uncle Aaron was in this, but I didn't know Prowler was in this. I just didn't know about the Rogues Gallery of villains.
And Tombstone, I didn't think he would say his name.
Yeah. I had to look up, I was like, I went home and Googled like Frankenstein guy. I didn't know Doc Ock was in this, but he walked into the classroom in his high school, and I was like, oh, that's Katherine Hahn. I wonder who Katherine Hahn's playing. Oh, she's probably a bad guy, right? Like, she's a scientist. She's probably a bad guy, but it did not occur to me. And I'm sure you noticed this, but if you pay close attention to that scene, where the footage of her is being shown, it says Dr. Olivia, and then like his body is blocking where it would have said Octavius, like in that scene there. So it just says Dr. Olivia under her name and under her face, and then the rest is like distorted out. And then just I kind of gasped at the reveal, like not that you need that surprise, not that I feel bad if anyone doesn't have the reveal, but it's just so well done, because she's like talking to Jake Johnson's Peter Parker, and she's just sort of like, and he's like, what's your last like, it's really well done. And the last thing I'll say is a line that I missed the first time that I caught the second time is when Peter Parker is laying out his plan to break into the lab. And he's like, find the head scientist. And there's like a guy there, and then she's in the background of the bike, and the Miles character goes like, oh, that lady's the head scientist. We heard about her. And he's like, ah, okay. Re-examine my preconceived notions about gender. And yeah. It got a huge laugh in my audience. So, yeah, it's just a fucking toss away. And that's the only thing we need to say about Doc Ock being a woman. And it's just sort of like, and what's amazing, is that you don't get her backstory like at all. Something that, you know, I don't think anyone from Sony is listening to this, but if you are, I apologize. I did spend some time looking at Sony emails, hacked emails this week. I resisted 4 years ago when they came out, but I finally started looking through a bunch of them. And something that Kevin Feige emailed them years and years and years ago, is he said, an issue that I have with Spider movies is I don't understand why you guys think that you always need a lengthy origin story for the villain as well as Peter Parker. So in every single movie, you have to follow the villain, like Doc Ock or Green Goblin or Hobgoblin or whoever it is, through their evolution from good guy to terrible accident to bad guy. He's like, can't there just be bad guys doing bad and already? And that's exactly like what, you know, Amazing Spider-Man, or no, Spider-Man 3, which is considered the weakest, that they make fun of in this movie briefly, was criticized because it had two villains, right? And it just felt like too many and too overpacked.
Three. It had three villains.
Who's the third? Who am I missing?
So it had Sandman, yeah. Venom, and then Green Goblin 2.
Yeah. Which I was calling good old Frank Goblin. Is that not Hobgoblin?
They technically called Green Goblin too.
Okay, so you had three villains, and you had three villain origin stories, and that's why it feels so laborious. Whereas in this, you've got five villains, or if you want to call it like two villains and then a bunch of henchmen, or Prowler is enough of a story. So like Scorpion and Tombstone are basically henchmen, and Green Goblin's a henchman. But you don't have to like get their origin stories. Like Kingpin's origin story is told so efficiently. And aided by the fact that a lot of us already know of it because we watched Daredevil, right? And so it's just, it's expediency of storytelling, in a way that I think is both influenced by Phil Lord and that note from Kevin Feige, you know?
Yeah. And then it's also interesting that I was I was very happy to see that they didn't dumb down Spider-Ham's origins, and he's still a spider that was bit by a radioactive pig.
Yeah.
Because it would be really easy to just switch that up like the animated show did, and was like, no, it's a pig that ate radioactive spider cereal or something. But no, they dedicated to the source material.
I talked to Dan Slott, a Spider-Man comics writer for VF, and he also singled that out. He's like, and they made the pig by the spider. I was like, it was so cool. He was also really happy about it. I want to talk to you about this. So the film starts with Peter Parker, played by Chris Pine, with blonde hair and blue eyes. And the journey that Dan Slott took me on was like, he was like, okay, the mask was ripped and there was a blue eye. And I was like, what the fuck? How are you going to have a Peter Parker with a blue eye? What are you talking about? And then the mask pulls off and he's got blonde hair. And I was like, oh, I get it. He's beautiful Aryan Peter Parker. He's Peter Parker where everything went right and nothing went wrong. But I really like that blue eye, blonde haired. And also a friend of mine took me on a whole journey this afternoon about, Ben Parker and Spider-Man clones and stuff like that. But like, that this is our Aryan poster child, Peter Parker, as voiced by Chris Pine. And that great shot of Jake Johnson's Peter Parker looking at him, the footage of him with his like bruised and battered face and just being like, he's perfect.
Yeah.
So good.
Oh yeah, I was really interested that none of the clones made it. Yeah, a lot of spider lore in here, including alternate suits for Chris Pine, dead Peter Parker, and you know, obviously the alternate spider people. And then in the credits themselves are a whole bunch of different spider people imagery. And I tried my best, but none of those are clone outfits. So I'm really wondering if, like, that's the line too far for Sony. Goddamn clones. But someone someday is going to try that line, and I will finally get to see Ben Reilly show up on screen. But yes, when he pulled off the mask and it was a blue-eyed, blonde-haired Peter Parker, I'm like, oh, if someone calls him Ben Reilly, I'm going to freak out.
I know. My friend sitting next to me, was like, Ben? I wonder if that's why he's called Peter B. Parker, you know, when Jake Johnson starts his whole thing. Anyway, origin stories, it handled so fucking well in this movie. And like, so poking fun at how many times we've seen the Spider-Man origin story while giving us the various spider people origin stories is just really incredible. So what else do we want to talk about in terms of spoiling, Spider-Verse?
Oh, the end. The end credits tag. Wait till the very end. Oscar Isaac shows up for a very brief comedic scene as Spider-Man 2099, Miguel O'Hara, who travels back to Spider-Man 67 or 68, the animated Spider-Man, to recreate a GIF. But also super interesting because he makes a Webwear watch, which is from the Edge of the Spider-Verse comics or the Spider-Verse comics. That's the thing that eventually lets people team up while normal Peter Parker and normal Miles Morales are off doing Marvel Universe things. So after Edge of the Spider-Verse revealed the Spider-Verse to everybody, certain spiders got these webwear watches, among them Jessica Drew, Spider-Woman, who made a all-female team of spider people who are sort of like a female group of secret agents in the multiverse for a while. It was Spider-Gwen, Silk, Aranya, Jessica Drew, and I think maybe at some point Betty Brant, Spider-Woman, might have shown up, but that might have been just like more of a one shot, as well as like, you know, all the clones would go off on each other. But the idea that these watches exist that allow them to traverse the web of time is the way that they get around now that they've sort of written Madam Web out of the continuity. Madam Web is only a reference you would enjoy if you watch the animated Fox Spider-Man series, Fox's Spider-Man Unlimited. But otherwise, she's like a multiverse, all-seeing female character that has been sort of replaced by these watches for interdimensional dynamic, interdimensional hijinks. Which presumably Gwen has one because she peeks through her universe at the end of this movie.
Who is the woman talking to Miguel with the coat and the glasses at the end?
That's his AI. It's like his sidekick, but it's a woman that is this computer woman.
Oh, it's like
it's his suit
Jarvis.
Lady. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. So the end opens up. And she says this whole thing. She's like, "You're gonna be the first person to ever, like, you know, traverse a multiverse, like, you know, on your own." Opening up the possibility for, yeah, Gwen to go visit Miles as their, like, verse cross lover story plays out or whatever. And oh my God, what if we got, like, a His Dark Materials with Gwen and Miles? But it just leaves them the opportunity, we should say, to not just do Into Spider-Verse 2 or this, Spider-Women thing that they said they're going to do, but also, like, if they wanted to just do a Spider-Ham movie that's basically like a Looney Tunes cartoon, they can do that. And so, like, what's interesting, you know, reading back through those Sony emails again, once again, like, at one point, Amy Pascal wrote when she was head of Sony Studios. Now she's still like, she's got Pascal Productions. She's like running the Spider-Verse still, even though she's no longer the head of Sony Studios. But like when she's the head of Sony Studios, she's like, are we hamstrung by the fact that other studios, major studios, own large, expansive, like, comic book properties, and we have just Spider-Man and his family and the villains, and that's why you get like a Sinister Six idea, which is just villains, or an Aunt May spinoff, which is the family. Like, the view was so limited, but that was 2014, like, when she was writing that. 2014 is when Dan Slott wrote Into the Spider-Verse, and that concept just blows open all the opportunities for them to just, like, do whatever the fuck they want, which is so cool. Like, yeah, they could do a Looney Tune and, like, you know, have a Spider-Man animated movie that's for little kids. The little kids would love it. You know what I mean? And they could do noir and make it more mature if they wanted to, or just like retro throwback or whatever. Like a Spider-Man musical. Like, who the fuck cares? You could do whatever you want. And that's like, that's the beauty of the multiverse. It's the beauty of this movie, which so cleverly, gets the concept of the multiverse, like, across to even someone who's never even heard a whisper of an idea of a multiverse, you know? Like, it's just, it's such a brilliant franchising move. And you, Dave, as like, the franchise king, like, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm just smiling because you said, like, they could do a musical, effectively erasing the fact that they did, and it was horrible. It was a disaster.
Turn off your thoughts on that musical. I did.
Remember when the Nazi bee villain was in the musical? Yeah, no, it's a great concept. And then I've always been a fan of, like, alternate Spider-Man costumes in general, because I think they're like cool designs, usually. So the idea when we opened up to like completely alternate Spider-Man was very, very interesting. And then obviously a lot of fun to go along when the comics were, you know, giving us new Spider-Man every week. But I think especially around 2011 when the Ultimate Universe decided to kill Peter Parker and allow Miles Morales to sort of come out of that. That's the storyline that, you know, he's trying his best and Aunt May gives him web shooters, and all those things are sort of, you know, rooted in that, those original Brad Michael Bendis, Sarah Pacelli comics. And I think it's really amazing that can be as Spider-Man. And in a few years, that might even be more Spider-Man than doing the rote Peter Parker, I went on a science experiment and my uncle got held up. So it's great to see the property evolve, especially not to brag, but it's one of my favorite properties. So to also see this happening while, you know, the DC universe finally gives its death throw in Aquaman, it's really satisfying to see that the idea of Spider-Man, the idea that anyone could be Spider-Man, is just as valuable as original Peter Parker was to teenagers who were reading comics and found those heroes unrelatable in the 60s and early 70s. The idea of like a relatable teenage Spider-Man then puts on a, you know, complete body covering suit and could be anybody under there is gonna work. And we didn't kill it.
Yeah, that's something that Dan Slott said to me, that like he said that Stan Lee had said to him, which is that the reason why Spider-Man is so appealing, and I guess maybe Iron Man could be so as well, is like because of the mask. Because of the mask, and it could be anyone under there. And that is the obvious thesis statement of this film, which is anyone can wear the mask, which is both like a slick, clever Sony Pictures way to open their franchise, to be like Spider-Gwen, Miles Morales, Spider-Ham, you know, Penny Parker, whoever we want, who the fuck ever we want is Spider-Man. You can't say otherwise. Even Stan Lee said so. I forgot where I started this. Anyway, you know, it's emotional as well as like good for business. And that's the thesis statement of this movie, you know? So, and then that whole idea that like, you know, as we reflect back on Stan Lee's legacy, when he just passed away, that whole idea that like the unifying, theme of a lot of his work is this idea of like the unexpected person can be a hero. And, you know, that's just exacerbated when like so many people can be heroes. And like, I just love like, but what this movie so cleverly does is just undercuts every moment that might feel too like sentimental with just like a sharp joke. Like a couple examples being like when, Mary Jane, as voiced by Zoe Kravitz, is giving this like eulogy for Peter Parker, and there are a bunch of mourners dressed in Spider-Man costumes, and including Miles, and she's like, you know, we are all Spider-Man and we are counting on you, and he goes like, oh, they're all counting me, and then that like rando guy in the audience is like, I'm pretty sure it's like a metaphor that don't actually
specifically
or later at the end of the at the like big climax when Miles sends Jake Johnson's Peter Parker home, and he's holding him, and they have that whole, conversation where like, oh, I get it. It's a leap of faith, which is a callback, of course, to what he said to Miles and all that sort of stuff. Jake Johnson's delivery is a nice, like, sort of like wry, like, yeah, oh yeah, it's the name of the show, sort of like, I get it, sort of thing. but then so Miles drops him. Kingpin comes for him, and then immediately Miles is quipping, and I was kind of teary-eyed by this, like, okay, our broken Peter Parker has to go home and try to fix what's hard. Like, he wanted to sacrifice himself so he didn't have to go face his problems at home. And that's an emotional and sort of like heavy idea to deal with. And then immediately Miles, completely outmatched by this giant Kingpin, is like darting around and quipping. And I was just reminded of something that you, Dave, said to me a long time ago on the Thought Bubble podcast. We were talking about Peter Parker, and you're like, Peter Parker, as much as like, I think both of us kind of liked Andrew Garfield, like Peter Parker can't be emo. Peter Parker is a quipper. Like you have to, when he's like zipping through the city or zipping around an enemy, he's got to be quipping. That's a part of who he is. And if he's not, then you've lost the beat on the character. And so when Miles started quipping, I just said Peter Parker a bunch of time and meant Spider-Man. When Miles Morales starts quipping, like I almost wanted to mutter out loud in my theater, oh, thank Christ, he's quipping. Like, this is amazing. You know? So it was like, yeah, it's great. Great stuff.
It's so great. Yeah. There's a, in the Spider-Man PS4 game, there's a suit power that just adds extra quips. So it doesn't give you a bonus or anything. It just changes up the quips so you get more jokes.
Oh,
Spider-Man. I love me some Spider-Man. Hey, Joanna, were you paying attention to the event that happened last Saturday in Brazil?
Last Saturday, as we're recording this. I knew there was a Comic-Con in Brazil because there was Game of Thrones stuff happening there. And as you know, I have but one interest in this world. But there was also some Marvel stuff happening there too, right, Dave?
Indeed. They showed the first Spider-Man Far From Home trailer. At this point, when we're recording it, we don't know when we're going to see it. The rumor is maybe the 18th now. But this was definitely just for the people in the room today, debut. And because of that, information spotty, so forgive me if any of this is wrong, but Jake Gyllenhaal showed up, not only to confirm that he was playing Mysterio, but apparently in some sort of conversation between him and Tom Holland, they hinted that Mysterio and Spider-Man will be teaming up to fight a group that uses elements as weapons. This might be the Marvel group, the Elementals. It might not. Who knows? But Peter Parker is in Europe when he's approached by Nick Fury and asked to deal with, I guess, some like elemental-powered heroes that might also involve former Nick Fury compatriot Mysterio. Is that all the information that's fit to print?
Amazing. Also, for the record, if you heard sirens just then, if Dave did not successfully edit them out for the podcast, I would want to say for once, they were not coming from Oakland. They were coming from Denver.
Yeah, that's true.
Those were Denver
sirens.
Spider sirens. All right. Do we want to talk about, does that make you excited that Far From Home news out of Brazil?
The Elementals is really an interesting choice. I had assumed that from leaked set photos and stuff, they'd be fighting like Hydro Man. But it also is interesting if it is true and it's not crazy people online trying to make me think false things that Mysterio was once a S.H.I.E.L.D. operative that is now going to be like an anti-hero that might evolve into something else. Very interesting. But all good. Says nothing about how he's still alive. But I guess that's what to expect.
So the Elementals, I mean, what's interesting is if they were to do the Elementals, because Marvel is also thinking of doing or planning to do the Eternals. Like, that feels, I don't know. It feels, that too feels too close. Though I guess this is Marvel Sony versus Marvel. I don't know.
Yes. And then also we don't know, like, how much of that plot is going to be, like, we're still pretty far out. So wouldn't surprise me if the Elementals is like part one of something. And like, we're looking at like a Bertrock the Leaper and a Winter Soldier like cameo, but just in case, here we go. The Elementals are Hydron, Lord of the Waters, Magnum, Master of the Earth, Hellfire, Wielder of Flame, and Zephyr, Mistress of the Winds.
Oh, Earth, Wind, and Fire is what we're saying? Your fucking Captain Planet is what we're doing right now?
The Elementals, Joanna.
Whose heart? Is Tom Holland heart? Is that what's happening?
Oh, God. The Mysterio's heart is probably the spoiler that we're all going to figure out. Anyway, we don't know if any of that's true yet. We do know that the trailer is going to show Spider-Man in Europe, show Nick Fury meeting him there, and then end with some sort of Mysterio reveal. And we might be getting it before the year's out.
All right. And we did not get the Far From Home trailer that we were expecting to get. We were hoping to get today, Saturday, last Saturday as you're listening to this. But we did get an Avengers 4 trailer. And in fact, we don't even need to call it Avengers 4 anymore, even though I got really used to it. We got the Avengers Endgame trailer. Dave, whilst not breaking any NDAs that some hosts of this podcast might have signed, what can we say about the Avengers 4 trailer?
I was totally right about the name.
You were, but like, I want to give you full credit. But what's also true is that like, that's what a lot of people thought it was. And mm-hmm. then, you know, I don't know if it was like due to some leak or whatever. And then Joe Russo told, Dave's friend, Mike Ryan, who works for UpRock. Mike Ryan was like, hey, did someone say the title of the Avengers 4 movie in Infinity War? Because Doctor Strange, that was a really clever way for Mike Ryan to ask that, because Doctor Strange says, we're in the endgame now, in Infinity War. And, Joe Russo says no. And a bunch of people, online this last week were like, well, you know, technically Dr. Strange didn't say we're in the Avengers Endgame now. So technically he didn't say the full title. Okay. My take on this, I don't like that Joe Russo said that, because what's probably true is that Endgame was at least a candidate for them for title at the time. What I believe based on no actual information, is that it was a title they were considering at the time, but they hadn't decided yet. But for Joe Russo just to say no feels too close to a lie to me. It feels too close to Jon Snow is dead and is not coming back to me, for comfort. Like, I just don't like that. I don't like it when creators, lie, however, like, seemingly harmless lying sounds like to journalists, because like, when we're journalists and we're out there asking questions, like, it's fucking hard enough as it is to get someone to like give you an answer. If you have to like deal with them just like lying to you, like, I have no issue if someone says no comment. I mean, let me say without breaking any NDAs that when I had a long chat with Kevin Feige for the Marvel cover story for Vanity Fair last year, he said, I'm not going to tell you anything about that, or just a smile and a no for so many questions that I asked. Just a smile and a no. And that was, I mean, like, that's an okay answer. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to answer that. So, sorry. Okay. Title aside, what else about the trailer?
No. That's a good point, because it was definitely a lie, because even if it wasn't Endgame at that point, it would have been the Gauntlet, which they were seriously considering to the point that they told some of the actors that's what it would be called. So, either way, Marvel lies, so that's good to know. Knowing that Marvel lies, we got an Endgame trailer that seemingly tells us nothing we didn't know at the end of Ant-Man and the Wasp, which means we got strung along for a few months. But in hindsight, that was a... Okay, go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't disagree with you. I'm not about to argue we know anything more, but it's just sort of like, I don't know about strung along. Like, they're allowed to just show us what they want to show us. I wish everyone would have a more free and open conversation about the fact that, like, you know, Marvel and other studios, but chiefly Marvel, straight up puts footage in their trailers that's frankly not in the movie, whether it's digitally altered or just like shot differently entirely, that they're just like creating I mean, the point of a trailer, really, outside of people who work in our industry, the point of the trailer is to get people excited about a movie. They really don't need to do much to get people excited about Avengers 4. Like, honestly, they could release no trailers and people would probably show up, right? But, you know, for us, the point of a trailer is to give us, like, clues to pore over so we can talk about. But that's not, like, what Marvel publicity is obliged to give us, right? They can give us whatever the fuck they want. And so if they think like a big hero shot in Avengers Infinity War trailer where Hulk is running towards the camera is what's going to get people excited to go to the film, like, that's fine. As long as they were like, I just wish more people would talk about it and be like, hey, yep, we got footage in there. It's just to get you excited. We got footage in there that's not in the movie at all. And then I wish fans would be more aware of that. And hopefully, like, you know, you guys listening can be aware of it. It's like, you know, if a shot of Shuri in the Avengers Endgame trailer makes you worried that she got snapped and you're going to fret about it for like a couple days, well, just know that like nothing you see in that trailer necessarily means anything except for the fact that Captain America has shaved his beard, and that's a hard loss for all of us, you know?
Yeah, especially that shot of Bruce Banner that you're talking about. Is completely altered because there's no reason that Bruce Banner would be looking at Scott Lang and Peter Parker. He literally has a joke in the first movie about how he doesn't know those two characters. So those screens are trailer only. They're meant to convey information to us as an audience about where they want us to be when this movie starts, headspace-wise. They don't want you thinking about Rocket. They don't want you knowing that Captain Marvel could fly throughout space. They don't want you thinking about whether or not Tessa Thompson and Korg are still alive. They want you back in that pocket of hopelessness that you left Infinity War in. For now, I don't think the movie's going to start that way. If you think about trilogy toppers, they have to stand on their own as films, even if they're the conclusion. So I think, you know, maybe like a Back to the Future 3 sort of continuation, but still like a very quick resetting, which might be getting in Ant-Man's van.
Question.
Yeah.
Given that this is what they showed, they showed us something that we should talk about, which is that they showed us Jeremy Renner's Hawkeye, seemingly in Japan, and like, you know, though comic book fans have been talking about this for a while, this is the first like official confirmation we seemingly get that Hawkeye will do some manner of the Ronin plotline that he has in the comic books. My question for you is, A, do you want to give our listeners like a brief sum up of what the Ronin plotline is? And B, you have been insisting all along that like Hawkeye and Scott wouldn't get snapped because they've got kids. But do you think, judging from what we saw in this trailer, that Clint, Hawkeye's family got snapped.
I like that theory more than doing like a Ronin thing. I don't know if explaining Ronin's super, I don't think that's going to line up with the where he is in Marvel at all. I like the idea in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that his maybe the kids is too brutal, but maybe his wife got snapped. At least it's Linda Cardellini. It's like a recognizable face. I would feel bad if she was gone from the Marvel Universe. I don't know about the kids. The kids like are faceless to me. But I do like that idea about that. I still think Cassie is alive because they've cast somebody as an older Cassie. So Scott Lang, I think, might be doing okay, or at least better than Hawkeye is when we catch up with him.
They cast an older Cassie?
They've cast, yeah, a slightly older Cassie.
Isn't that the best indication? Isn't that the best official indication we have left that there is a serious jump forward in time in this film?
Best indication that we have left?
What?
Oh, I don't know if we have it. I think it's definitely, I think time is definitely involved in this film. I think it's the shot in Infinity War when, Thanos undoes Vision blowing up, and those are the same colors in motion that are being used to put the A back together in the title for Avengers Endgame. So I think we're time undoing things, whether it's time vortexing or time stoning or just time jumping. It's time.
That's a fun little thing that I didn't notice or know about. So people are saying that that's because they're used that color to put the A together. That's a little nod to what happens with Vision. And so that's definitely means that there's going to be time.
The only time we've seen that reforming is the time gem effect in both, sure, Doctor Strange and in Infinity War.
So yes. Yeah, so as I like to call it, this is a phrase that I have coined and it's very scientific. Wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff is happening in Avengers 4.
Mm hmm.
We're in the end game now, folks. Also, we should mention that they have moved the date of Avengers Endgame, which a lot of people suspected that they would, forward by a week, so from May into April, which puts it right about where I estimate the season 8 premiere of Game of Thrones will be. So fuck you, mm-hmm, universe.
we're gonna have a podcast on something.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, we may not know what we're gonna be doing the last week of April 2019 yet, with all the incoming content, but we do know that next week it is time to do our Star Wars replacement for the year of 2018. It's hashtag Poppins hype.
Chim chim. Mary Poppins. True, motherfuckers.
Mary Poppins is going to return. And Mary Poppins returns. We're going to check it out. We're going to let you know how pleasant it is and if you should check it out during your holiday break. And then I think the week after that, we're going to do some superlatives, great debates about media and whatnot. But make sure to check in next week for some Poppins hype. It's going to be great. Until then, Joanna, where can people find your work online? All that amazing Spider-Verse stuff that you've been plugging this episode, where can we find?
All that spider content can be found on vanityfair.com starting Monday through the week. Just wall to wall, web to web spider stuff. And then you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I'm also doing a lot of Game of Thrones stuff on VF.com right now, which I would love for you to check out. I also have a lot of Poppins type stuff coming up on VF.com. So it's like a good game of Spider Poppins time for Joe Wrote good old Joe Wrote This on VF.com. How about you, Dave?
You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find me on my podcast, Fighting in the War Room, at fightinginthewarroom.com. You could find me writing about the Spider-Verse at Thrillist.com. And then we're coming up on like top 10 of the year awards things. So I'm trying to see all the movies so I could narrow my picks down. It's going to be, it's a push. It's the end of the year media push. It's cold outside, it's warm inside. Let's all watch some stuff together. It's going to be fantastic. So until next week, you're allowed to whip anywhere you want, but do not whip down.